This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and on today's show, we'll begin with a roundtable with co-hosts Jennifer Doyle and Gustavo Arellano, author of the syndicated column Ask a Mexican. And I think you know what we'll be asking him about, Mexico's exit from the World Cup. And then we'll ask an Englishman, Paul Mason, for his thoughts about England's exit from the tournament. Much will be said, of course, about the rotten refereeing in both matches today, but also there's going to be a lot of appreciation of the great performances put in by Argentina and Germany. Then our featured interview today is with Peter Aleggi, author of African Soccerscapes. Peter Aleggi is in South Africa for the World Cup tournament, and we'll ask him to reflect both on the performance of the African sides in the World Cup and his impressions of how the tournament is going in South Africa. And finally, we're joined by Andrew Terranova from the Southern California Footballistas. Andrew will explain why he believes that American leftists should not support Team USA in the World Cup. All that and more on The People's Game. This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky.
And I'm Jennifer Doyle.
Quite a day at the 2010 World Cup. Not a good day for the International Brotherhood of Referees, though, as Germany and England, Mexico and Argentina, the big headline of Argentina wins big, Germany wins big, are sort of matched by refs blow call. What do you make of it, Jennifer?
Well, there's a couple interesting things to say. I mean, well, first off, obviously, England played a terrible game anyway, so it's hard to say that if Lampard's goal had been allowed, they would have won the game. It is, without a doubt, it's not in dispute, right, that Lampard's goal, which bounced off the top bar, the crossbar, landed several feet behind the goal line, maybe 2-3 feet behind the goal line, and this was not seen by the sideline ref, and it was ignored. So it was completely ignored. And I think Lampard knew it, and if he didn't, he would have known it very shortly after, because they actually replayed that moment on the Jumbotron in the actual stadium. And so the players and the fans actually at the match itself saw that this goal had been disallowed. I don't think that you can underestimate the degree to which such a thing can change the affect and mood of a match. So that said, you know, a great team, a better side, should have been able to overcome it, and they were so completely outplayed by Germany on every single level that it's really hard to look at that moment and say that that failure on the referee's part to award the goal was the thing that broke England. I mean, I think England was clearly no match for Germany. They absolutely appeared as if they played in different leagues. Germany's such a young and attacking and creative side. I think they're both they're surpassing people's expectations of them already, but they're also, I think, complicating people's expectations that are based on old notions about how Germany plays.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a tremendously exciting game to watch. So, you know, England absolutely deserved to lose that, in my opinion, though it's a shame that they have this thing to latch onto and to hang all of their bitterness and anger on. I could hardly blame the team for that. I if I were a player, I would feel that the entire match was polluted by that, because it's not a marginal call. I mean, the ball really was very clearly behind that touched the goal line. So we have that, which is a lot, you know. And then with the game between Mexico and Argentina, a shocking offside goal from Tevez. I mean, he's nowhere near the offside line. He's well past it, absolutely well past it, and he heads the goal in. And I mean, the ball was actually most likely going to go into the net anyway, so he helped it along. And if he had actually just stepped away from the play, he would have been fine, right? And they probably would have scored. But he definitely, it was an offside goal, and it was so obvious that actually the linesman actually told the center ref that he made a mistake. And again, that moment was replayed in the stadium, and everyone saw it. The players saw it. The people in the stand saw it. And that's why there's a bit of mayhem on the field, where all the players from both sides collected around the linesman. It was because everyone had just seen this. But it was too late. There was nothing that could be done. And I really do feel, whereas I think England really lost that match to a superior team, I do think that Mexico was broken by that. I think that in my experience of watching Mexico, they can be a very emotional side and very reactive. And the second goal that they gave up was just a terrible, weak pass. It's the kind of thing that's made by a player who almost doesn't care, or like, you know, it's hard for me not to attribute that to the sort of emotional wake of that awful moment of giving up a goal. You know, basically, it's a cheat. I mean, it was a really just miserable thing. And Mexico played a decent game otherwise. I mean, mm-hmm. at times they really looked like they were in control of the match. I mean, it wasn't at all a case where Mexico was going to lose that in any way. I mean, I do think that actually interfered with the game very profoundly. So it's a lot in one day. I feel bad for people who are new to the sport and who are watching this and think that somehow this is what the game is about. And I just don't think that's true. So I'll obviously be digesting this for quite a long time. So,
or at least until Netherlands and Slovakia kick off tomorrow. And we're joined on the line by Gustavo Arellano. He is the author of the syndicated column Ask a Mexican, and his most recent book is Orange County, A Personal History. Welcome to the People's Game, Gustavo.
Hey, ¿qué tal? What's up?
Mexico's exit from the 2010 World Cup Finals. Your thoughts?
Of course it was going to happen. In fact, I refused to see the game because I knew it was going to get ugly. See, me and Argentina, we have a very nasty history together. And Mexico, God bless El Tri, God bless them, but they just didn't have a team that was had the same enthusiasm, the same ganas that, say, some of the other teams like Ghana and South Korea have. And then going up against a juggernaut like Argentina, esos hijos de puta, forget it, man. I knew it was going to be embarrassment, and it was.
I'm kind of with you there insofar as I think that, you know, they got a really, really bad break. I mean, just a phenomenally bad break. But I think if they'd had more in them, more in the tank, or I don't, more belief in themselves, they'd overcome it and, you know, and play harder and play with more focus. And instead, they just completely collapsed after that moment and then spent the rest of the game trying to recover.
If you want to take the grand view, you could say this was predestined given, you know, we're going into Octavio Paz territory, kind of slowly into the black legend territory. Basically, Mexico, all Mexicans, we knew we were going to lose to Argentina. We knew that even if we'd put up this grand gallant effort, we would probably lose to a far superior team. So it was almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, and nothing against El Tri. I thought that they fielded a good squad, but just when it comes to the cup, it's just we always seem to shoot ourselves in the foot, and you know, it's frustrating as hell. And you know, and in Argentina, I wish obviously we won the game, but the fact that we lost to Argentina, it's only crushing to me on a personal level, on the game level. They play a beautiful game. At the very least, I want Maradona to win the cup and just go after all those naysayers from Argentina, all the elite who have always despised him for everything that he stands for.
What would a victory over Argentina meant to Greater Mexico, which we're in right now?
You think the Algerians in Paris went crazy after their team lost the cup? Mexicans all across Greater Mexico. That's actually a term that the great Chicano study scholar Américo Paredes created. Greater Mexico would have erupted, not in riots, but in marching on the streets, horns honking down Huntington Park in Southern California and Bristol Street in Santana. It would have been... I honestly think it would have been the greatest soccer victory for Mexico ever, honestly, just because the entire world, the odds against us were enormous. And Mexico, hey, of course they put up an effort. It's just they didn't do it in the end. They didn't do it in the end.
Yeah, I'm going to say something in support of fans of Mexico. I watched the game at Loteria on Hollywood Boulevard. It was packed with green shirts. There were five people in Argentina jerseys in the room, and at the end of the match, in unison, everyone in green started chanting Germany, which is who Argentina play next. So immediately transferring their loyalties right to Germany, sort of in pursuit of revenge. And then I had the impression that basically all in attendance were about to go out on a binge and continue to have a good time. So I wouldn't say that the loss was something that people took all that hard. I think it's sort of take it in stride and sort of a longer history with the team, basically. So I have a little theory, though, and it's not just mine. This is actually kind of emerging as a kind of trend in the Twittersphere and the blogosphere. Every team that has participated in that atrocious, bloated, sexist Nike commercial, Write the Future, is doomed for failure.
Huh.
It's England, France, and Italy were all featured prominently in it. It was a Mexican director who's responsible for it, Iñárritu, made the film. And so all we have left is Portugal and Ronaldo. He's the only marquee player left standing who features in that commercial called Write the Future, interestingly enough. So I'm rooting for Ronaldo choking on a penalty kick and getting thrown out for excessive diving.
Though there's one other side represented in the commercial as part of the heroes of the commercial, but the player never was in the tournament. That's Ronaldinho's Brazil.
Yes, that's right. And that's the one little bit of wiggle room is that Ronaldinho features in the ad and he's doomed before the World Cup even starts because he was not selected. So it's just it's actually bad luck, that ad.
I think that's a great theory. I'm also with you, Jennifer. Cristiano Ronaldo is going to play the great diva that he is, and he's not going to be able to score anything against Spain. Spain is going to – and what's interesting, you have the two great conquistadors, the two great creators of Latin America, this match that should have been played centuries ago, and actually was played centuries ago. And, of course, ever since the colonial game, they've been nothing if not another group of underachievers, and especially here in soccer. So I do predict Spain will be able to vencer over Portugal. And Portugal, I've never been impressed with that team. I don't know how they've been as highly ranked as they have. I've never been impressed with them. Cristiano Ronaldo, whatever. No big deal.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. Whatever.
but I'm also with you, Jennifer. Of course, Mexicanos. I mean, we've always known how to take losses, especially devastating them ones. We know how to take them in great form. You know, whether it's the Narco Wars, the swine flu that messed with us, our eternal tango or norteña with the United States. We have some of the best gallows humor in the world. We don't hold that against Argentina. You know, well, of course, we're going to go for Germany, but we're not going to just despise them forever and ever more. They are, after all, they're not our true rivals anyway in the global game, as it were. It's always been the United States and always will be. Now, Argentina, yeah, of course, we're going to be against them, but, you know, it's not like they're Guatemala or El Salvador specifically.
Well, I seem to remember the last time that Mexico hosted the cup, Argentina hoisted the cup.
Yeah.
I have a question to ask a Mexican. Tomorrow morning, 7 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, Greater Mexico, having been knocked out of the tournament, do they en masse wake up, turn on the television, and continue watching the World Cup?
Of course. Es el Mundial. Even though we lost, we're still football fans at heart. I want to see what's going to happen with the ESPN ratings, if they're going to tank now that the U.S. is gone, now that the media no longer has a narrative to care of, now that Matt Drudge doesn't care anymore about putting up his little pictures online. But with the Mundial, with Mexico gone, of course, we want to see Ghana go on. We want to see, let's see how far Argentina goes, or, let's see how far Germany goes. Their game against England, my God, I don't think anybody was expecting that. Of course, everyone was expecting England to tank. That's all they did this cup. But Germany, the supposedly efficient to the point Germany, unleashing four goals on England. Wow. Good for them, by the way.
Yeah, good for them. And they're also now kind of fronted by, in essence, a guy who belongs to the Chicano equivalent population of Germany. He is Turkish-German, Ozil, and a fantastic player. So I'm almost on the verge of being able to root for Germany. I thought that they played a beautiful game, so I'm looking forward to that matchup.
That's true. Turks are the Chicanos of Germany. I mean, if anything, you want to talk about people without a country, it's Turks, because at least here in the United States, we have the humanity to be able to grant birthright citizenship to Mexicanos who are born here. But in Turkey, and correct me if I'm wrong, Jennifer, but I don't think that's still the case with Turks, even though they've been there now, a good 60 years.
Yeah, Germany just manages to put people through a kind of elaborate bureaucratic paperwork processes in which you're constantly forced to choose, am I German, am I Turkish? And this individual player actually kind of publicly kind of acted that out as Germany and Turkey were both kind of wrestling over the rights to claim him for their team. So it's an he's an interesting story. I look forward to learning more about him.
And so a lot of love going forward from Greater Mexico for Germany, or is this particular to you? Does Maradona cannot expect the support of Aslan?
No, we love Maradona. Come on, who except the elite does not like Maradona? Honestly, I mean the guy was an amazing player. What he represented, just Argentina, alguien, you know, the sangre de indio, mestizo, in a traditionally all European sport. He's a legend. The fact that the elites would always be embarrassed by his antics, and even to this day, just remember all the trash that people talked about Maradona, all the naysayers who said he was not going to be able to lead them in the cup, even those, you know, some of the players from Argentina who refused to play under Maradona. He's having the last laugh right now. His team
really
destroyed
is.
The competition, got 9 points, beat Mexico. I'm sure that they'll beat Germany too. That's going to be a great game, though, to see Germany go up against Argentina. So, basically Maradona, he's a Mexico living in Argentina. He is one of the Mexicans of Argentina.
And again, that's a rematch from 2006 again, where Argentina was up 1-0, Germany tied, and Argentina was eliminated on penalty kicks.
No, I can't wait. I'm with you, Gustavo, and also most of the people that I play soccer with in Los Angeles. A lot of us have picked Argentina as the team that's likely to win the whole thing. And so there's a way that you have to give him respect, and I think a lot of people are also just rooting for him, partly because he's so unwilling to perform the role of, you know, happy to serve the Sith Lords of FIFA.
Right.
He's a great figure and totally entertaining. So I hope we see him in the tournament for more and more.
I would ask or recommend to the listeners out there to read an article that came out in Der Spiegel magazine, the German magazine. They also have an English language edition. And they did this great story in Maradona, I think right before the Cup started or maybe right at the beginning, but just detailed and profiled the love-hate relationship that Argentina has with Maradona, how he's loved by the masses but hated by the intelligentsia. But then, of course, you know, his record of success, it can't be denied, but there's this great passage in the story where I guess he has a personal watcher to make sure he doesn't relapse to his prior excesses. And so the watcher was talking about how, I guess last time Maradona was gravely ill, I can't remember if he had a stroke or a heart attack, he was reduced to driving around all the hospitals of Buenos Aires, and all the hospitals were refusing to let him inside the doors because they didn't want to be known as the hospital where Maradona would have died. It was a great, great story. So I would recommend all people see it. Maybe I'll put it up on Facebook tonight, actually.
Yeah, I think the story's called God's Gift to Argentina, ?
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
Yeah.
And by the way, for people who don't know, it's incredibly difficult to get interviews with the players or coaches during the World Cup. FIFA controls the press pool in a dictatorial manner, not unlike the White House press pool. And so I call upon all listeners of The People's Game to assist us in the interview that we seek most of all, which is our interview with Diego Maradona. So Gustavo and Jennifer, you can help put the call out. We will give Diego an opportunity to speak to all of the people of Greater Mexico and the United States and the world here on The People's Game.
Do it.
Got to think big.
I wish Mexico would have gone on. They didn't. I do hope, as a Mexican's viewpoint in the world, there's always hope. Even in the face of the biggest disaster, even in the face of the sheer calamity, we always have hope. And I got to say, we always pick ourselves back up. So I do predict next Mundial, we have a great batch of young players. Chicharito is going to only get better. So I predict next Cup around, and we're going to do better. That's the only thing you can say, right? We're going to do better. That's the only way we could go on in this miserable world.
Hey, it's the third straight elimination in the second round. The last two with Argentina, not as painful as the one 3 World Cups ago.
No. Thank God, no. Oh, my God, it happened. Who knows what would be happening right now.
Jennifer, final thoughts?
I am actually still sort of licking my wounds. I was really pulling for Mexico, and I wish that their loss had not been tainted by a bad refereeing call. It's become the story of the World Cup, one call like that after another, and I just think it's a shame. But I'm with Gustavo. I think that Mexico's just on its way up. I mean, it's younger players are real stars, and I'm looking forward to watching them play the next couple of years in their club teams and then the next World Cup.
This is the People's Game. This is our roundtable for today with Gustavo Arellano, author of the syndicated column Ask a Mexican, and, of course, co-host Jennifer Doyle. The blog is From a Left Wing. I'm Alan Minsky, and we will be right back with Paul Mason of the BBC to talk in detail about Team England and all of their failings. This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined right now by Paul Mason. He is the economics editor for BBC Newsnight and has a marvelous blog called Idle Scrawl. Paul Mason is in London, England. He is obviously a partisan of the English national team. Paul, what do you make of the performance today? What do you make of the performance in the tournament?
Well, very poor in both respects, I think, today. I mean, obviously they had this setback of the goal that was disallowed, the Lampard goal. It was clearly a goal. And in any other situation, you might expect that to have been a deciding influence. But I don't think it was in the end. I think England reverted to type. I think they played in the same poor way that they played throughout the tournament. And that is simply, it's a lack of teamwork. Now, I think, again, why is the lack of teamwork happening? It's just that the players seem to have been just in revolt throughout the entire tournament against Capello's desire to impose on them some kind of system.
Now, I thought what this team really missed was a Paul Scholes. Really, really missed aggressiveness in midfield.
They missed not only a Scholes. I mean, I'll tell you what they really missed. They missed a Gascoigne. If you ever remember Paul Gascoigne playing, they missed a midfield playmaker. Now, the thing is you can have aggressiveness in midfield and you can chop people down. Actually, did you see the number of the yellow cards? Minimal in the entire game. What that tells me, actually, it's an interesting little statistic, that the England team were backing off all the time, as you could see from the TV coverage of it. I mean, England games, you know, games in England do not finish with one yellow card. Big games. There was just something really wrong about them. And I think you could say the midfield was poor, but above all today for the England team was the defence didn't work. John Terry out of position all the time. Upson, the new guy, not really functioning. Glenn Johnson, not fast. Ashley Cole, the one world-class defender, just occasionally fired on all three cylinders or whatever, but never quite got there. So that defence wasn't working. I mean, the goalie was brilliant, I thought, but the defence were poor. And football teams, as you know, work like a pyramid. It works from the bottom up. And with the defences no good, there's not really much you can do in midfield.
Well, you're a Man U supporter.
Mm-hmm.
You know Wayne Rooney's performances intricately. He did seem very flat. I mean, while it's true what you say about the defence, he seemed not to have brought his A game to South Africa.
No, I mean, the thing about Wayne is that he tries like a maniac. He tries a lot over and above the call of duty. Now, there is a theory going around in the British sporting press that I have come around to, actually, and that is that he's been affected by altitude training. Because at the end of every match, Wayne Rooney looks white. He looks drained of energy. And he's off the pace. Now, it's hard to spot that because the whole team is off the pace. But I think he's not been served by the formation. As football aficionados listening to your program will know, Wayne Rooney plays in a 4-4-1-1 situation. That is, there is another striker dropping back off him, and he's up there on his own with the Man U situation. And sometimes those strikers and sometimes the midfielders running onto me. I mean, in the last two or three years, it has been the people like Cristiano Ronaldo, like Tevez. It's Ryan Giggs. I mean, he is served by an amazing array of international talent.
Right, Nani, so, Valencia, right.
Absolutely. And the problem is, I mean, maybe in England we're just finding out that without that bought-in international talent, our really good players are only average.
Right.
That could be the theory.
Well, Lampard and Gerrard did look just especially flat. Obviously, Lampard had you know, the dramatic moments in the in the game, and very much involved Frank Lampard today. But you know, it's 2-1 around the 60th minute. Lampard lines up for a free kick. Everybody knows what he's going to do. He's going to smash it as hard as he can. What the hell is all of the defense doing forward?
Well, I can only believe, because they got caught twice on the break by the Germans, I can only believe that either Capello had told them to sacrifice everything and go forward, or that they had decided it themselves. That it's not an accident when stuff like that happens. So the entire defense is out of position. And you think about it, that in, if you put it into baseball or NFL terms, right, it would be unbelievable that an entire sub-team, so four guys, are out of out of position. So I think somebody has decided to do it. Now, the problem here is that you actually don't need that in soccer. You just don't need to do that. So I think it was a collective failure. And in each case, they get hit on the break. In each case, it's over the moment the ball comes out of the opposition 18-yard box. It's actually over. You can see, if you replay those moves, it's not like anybody could have done anything about it. But so those two goals are unforgivable. And the post-mortem, I think, must involve who told them to push so hard that the defense stopped being the defense.
Do you think Fabio Capello remains the manager of England?
Well, look, the default position here in England is to criticize Capello. I don't take that view, because I think Capello was right to try and make them play with the system. Because if you're going to win a tournament, you have to perfect a system and then change it. England never got to the point of perfecting the system. So he couldn't then change it and improve it and make it go 4-4-1-1 or 4-3-3. He could never do it, because the players never got it. I think we will probably find, as these individual accounts come out in the press, that there was some kind of ongoing revolt against the rigidity and draconian nature of Capello's regime. But I think England need that regime, and they are going to have to, you know, basically buckle under and accept it from somebody, even if they don't accept it from him. There are a collection of talented and mediocre individuals who are performing collectively below their par. Now, in business, which is my specialism, we know what to do about that. Mm-hmm. You do replace the management. You have to. And you also have to get some better individuals, and if your system doesn't produce it, you look at the system. I think we have to do all three of those things. He hasn't worked, and the problem is here, I mean, I don't know how many American viewers have seen this, he also can't communicate to the English people under stress. So it's not an irrelevant issue for our 62 million people watching this on the TV today that he can't actually string three words of English together to explain it.
Mm-hmm.
And given that, you know, the guys themselves are just young guys, and they're not going to speak out of turn, they're not going to come up with their own theory within 20 minutes of coming off the field. He saw it. And you do, as a manager, you do have this duty to communicate to the client. The client is the English people, and they didn't like the product.
You look at the team, and I think that four of the outstanding English players have now come of age and passed the age where they'll be in the national team. So John Terry, Frank Lampard, Steven Gerrard, and Rio Ferdinand, who missed the tournament, their international careers are, they certainly won't go past the Euro tournament, I imagine.
No.
So a new generation has to come up. What do you see in terms of a new generation coming
up?
Well,
our under-17 team is good. We have a problem in Britain that we have a very vibrant and very, it's very rooted in society, our soccer culture. It isn't soccer moms, it's soccer dads. Mm-hmm. And those soccer dads can be from the roughest, toughest neighborhoods. Now, what that means is that on the football field, for us, we got 9-year-olds who are being judged by their ability to shoulder other 9-year-olds off the ball.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So we all know there's something deeply wrong here. We need to rebuild our game so that, to be honest, it's more middle class at the lower level. So that clever guys who might want to get a scholarship at university. You know, we don't have that system here. No footballer goes to university.
Mm-hmm.
But clever guys might want to stay in the sport until they're 22. We have to do that. Until we do that, it'll always be luck. And we lucked out with somebody like Rooney. Rooney, Ferdinand, who sadly couldn't play in the tournament, We got one or two decent players, but I think it's not the problem. I would rather go on the field with the Algerian team. Everybody on it is unheard of. They all have a spirit. They gnash their teeth. They've trained to the point where their bodies couldn't be lighter. It's not true of the England team, of course. And they all want something. Now, they still lose, but they lose in a way that makes you feel like they... Not that they try, everybody tries on the football field, but that the system was geared to allow their effort to have results. And our system seems to have been geared to allow our players' effort to work against them. And this is... I mean, we're all going to have to sit down in the UK, in England, and work out what's going on. But I do think it is our youth game. It's the preponderance of our club game. I mean, we're the only country in the world where every national player plays for a club in England. That's the amazing thing. What are those clubs? They're clubs primarily staffed by foreign players. So it's almost like if you're looking for the big obvious thing, that's the big obvious thing. We have sold our league to money, and it doesn't help us produce a great national team. What it helps us is produce maybe 10, 15 really excellent world club teams.
It's funny because I do look at the side that could be pieced together right now, and I actually see a hole right around the four players that I mentioned, because you have Johnson. I think Ashley Cole probably is still around as of next World Cup. You have Walcott. You have Johnson from Man City, Aaron Lennon. Defoe, I think, will still be around. Carlton Cole. Obviously, Rooney's up front.
Yep.
And besides Upson, I don't see anybody who fits into central midfield or the central defense.
Was the third understudy.
Right.
We had a whole bunch of understudies in central defense.
Right. But nobody in the Paul Scholes, Frank Lampard, or Steven Gerrard mold, of those molds.
Look, the thing is you could. I just believe if you see some of these so-called second-rate teams who have trained and drilled, that it's not about individual prowess.
Right.
It's actually about team work. And the weird thing is in British sport, we have some amazing... We have a sport, rugby union, similar to NFL, where the disciplines are similar to NFL. As they say, the top 2 inches of the body are the most important.
Mm.
It's all about brain work and therefore teamwork. And we just don't seem to have understood this in football, in soccer. We've understood it everywhere else. Obviously, it's nice to have Rooney. It's nice to have Ashley Cole. I mean, we had some decent goalkeepers. You know, James, in the end, was a decent goalkeeper. I think Glenn Johnson will come good as a defender.
Mm-hmm.
But Joe Cole has 2 more years left in him as an attacking wide player. But we just need a system. That's what we don't have.
To shift gears for a while, obviously the English national team will evolve as it evolves. And right after this tournament, within a few months, starts qualification for the Euro, so they'll get right back to it. FIFA, obviously today in both matches, huge controversies. And I'm just wondering, just curious as the, you know, obviously somebody who follows large global institutions with great power, what kind of insight you can provide into FIFA, if any?
The closer you go to FIFA, the more weird the story gets.
That's my sense.
That's the only thing you can say about it. I don't have an inside line to FIFA, but it is, you know, I mean, look, you know, it's not the only sporting body that does strange things.
Right.
We all know the story about how amazingly, you know, Taekwondo became an Olympic sport when karate didn't. And I'm an ex-Taekwondo guy, and I kind of have a feeling about how that happened. And it's the same with all these. The problem is, look, they're not actually subject to democratic scrutiny. The sports journalists don't go up to them, actually ask them the kind of questions that political journalists ask politicians. They're not open to scrutiny. The systems aren't open to scrutiny. It's all very, very strange, and that's the best you can say about it.
Right, right. It's what can you say? Also, they're throwing the most successful event in the world, right? If this goes on through the quarterfinals and semis, they'll hopefully respond to the outcries.
Well, the technology issue is there. It's been on the table for years. Actually, so has the limitation of club squads to a limited number of foreign players. That's there. It's there in Germany. So has the rest period in the winter. The Germans have the rest period. Now, the thing is that what you would have to do to make any of this work is that this amazingly powerful sport, this multi-billion sport, would actually have to be regulated. It's a bit like banking, really. You know, to make it work better for the people who are the ultimate clients, which is us, the Joe Blow, on the you know, watching it on the television, somebody would have to say certain things aren't possible. But with international football, it's almost nothing is not possible. The only thing that seems to be impossible are relatively sensible decisions, the kind of decisions that an ordinary sort of town meeting might come to. These are not possible.
You know, it is funny because the goal taken away from Lampard would really call for technology. The Tevez decision in the Mexico game, you can see the argument you don't want to have everything go to technology and offsides. But boy, was that one. That was so glaring.
There were both glaring errors. The difference being, I think, that you can see where, look, the psychology, football's a human game. So the psychology of playing in a certain way to get certain decisions is well known. I think, really, the flair that Argentina showed to get into the position of that goal had in the back of the mind of that touch judge, the line judge, really, this is a goal.
Mm, yeah.
But I think whatever happened with the ref and the line judge in the Lampard thing,
the Carlos Tevez is a big object to miss with the naked eye.
But look, actually, as well, when you watch it without the benefit of stop motion, there is a way of seeing it where, albeit a wrong way, but there's a way of seeing it where he looks onside. It's to do with the angle you look at it from, and the moment you blink as the ref. I think at the end of the day, I'm in favour of. There's a debate started here about how would you do the technology. The default position is people would allow appeals, like you do in tennis. You get three line calls, and you're allowed to dispute three times. I wouldn't. I'd do it. I'd just basically have a fifth ref. I'd have a real-time monitoring of the video, and I'd have an intercom system where somebody says, blow the whistle.
Right. I think that sounds wise, actually, as long as it's real-time.
You've got the yellow flag thing in NFL, that little yellow thing that goes in, you know, that kind of dart, whatever it is. Three guys start throwing these darts. Everybody knows to stop. That's the key thing. You can always restart. Everybody says, it would make football less flowing. Well, you know, it's not that flowing now, to be honest. So many people play for stoppages, whether it's touch or the diving. You stick it into touch, you dive. This is a way of stopping the action in football, and the referee stopping it would not, to me, spoil the spectacle.
Two final questions and sort of the obvious questions. One is the national mood in England. Follow-up question, any fun tabloid headlines that you've caught a glimpse of?
Well, the tabloids aren't out yet. I haven't seen the tabloids. Mm. They'll be fun. I think this time, you know, we've had two dysfunctional management and player systems, 06 and 2010. Sven let the players keep control. There was total player power. This time, I read the end of this campaign as being player power running up against a decent manager who didn't want to let it happen. Causes mayhem. So our fundamental problem is going to be player power. Now, the tabloid headlines, of course, a lot of these players write little ghost columns for these tabloid newspapers, and let's see how hard the tabloids are on their friends, the players, tomorrow morning. My hunch is they'll be just hard on the England setup and the coach. The mood is very defeated and defeatist. I mean, you saw how we played in the first three games. Mm-hmm. Nobody's surprised.
Mm-hmm.
If we played fantastically well and this was a sudden aberration, that would be different. But a lot of the people I've blogged on this tonight, bbc.co.uk/Paul Mason, and a lot of the responses to that and on Twitter are saying, you know, right on, you are right. It's the structure of the game. It's the fact that the club game is oversold, it's over-leveraged. We have borrowed money, and we have bought players, but it hasn't solved our problems as a national game. And in that respect, you know, I do think England's performance tonight was almost like the Lehman Brothers of football. You borrowed, and what it turned out that the borrowing masked a kind of underperformance.
Well, Paul Mason, I want to thank you for joining us on The People's Game. Paul Mason's the economics editor.
Hey, commiserations to the USA, though.
Oh,
they played very courageously.
A lot of heart. Actually, the inverse, perhaps, of England. They maybe don't have the talent at certain places, but they really had a ton of heart.
Yeah, but look at Ghana. Ghana had the heart, and they had the coaching. I think that's what's going to win it. They're not going to win it, but the people who are going to win it this time are people with flair and coaching. Well, why we in England are so crazy, we try and throw the coaching part of it out the window.
Well, we did.
The player doesn't do it on its own, even if you got it, even if they turn it on.
Well, Germany-Argentina should be quite a match.
Woo-hoo. Yep.
Thank you so much, Paul Mason. And again, the blog is Idle Scrawl. Check it out, and thank you for joining us.
Bye-bye.
This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined right now by Peter Alleggi. He is an associate professor of history at Michigan State University and the author of a brand new book, African Soccerscapes: How a Continent Changed the World's Game. Peter Alleggi has been on a year-long sabbatical in South Africa, where we reached him today. Peter Alleggi, welcome back to The People's Game.
Thanks for having me, Alan.
So you've written this fantastic book about the history of soccer in Africa, and so much anticipation when we last spoke about the performance of the African sides. Your book really contextualizes soccer in a broader social context, but you also have a great amount of detail about the sort of national soccer traditions. Six teams making it into the tournament in South Africa, and we'll talk about Ghana, the one team that remains. But what do you make of the performance of the African sides in the group stages, in particular the five sides that didn't qualify for the second round?
Well, of course, everyone would have been quite happy here if more than one team had qualified for the round of 16. But let's keep in mind that, never have African more than two teams made it from Africa into the round of 16. So I think, to be realistic, it would have been nice if two had made it. And, Ivory Coast was drawn in a very tough group with Brazil and Portugal, as well as North Korea, and they were probably the best African side in addition to Ghana, and they came very close. They were eliminated on the last day of that first round. Also, Nigeria was within one goal of qualifying, and South Africa was eliminated on goal difference. So if you look at the details, I think the African sides did reasonably well and came very close from having two teams in the round of 16. So, there is a bit of disappointment here in South Africa for the home team in particular coming so close and not qualifying. But, at the same time, everyone's behind Ghana now, and they are, 90 minutes away from making history and being the first African side to reach the semifinals.
Cameroon and Ivory Coast in particular, and Nigeria actually, three sides that have incredible talent on their team. In your book, African Soccerscapes, you relate the history of soccer in many of the countries, and one of the criticisms that's been leveled, or maybe not even a criticism, but just sort of a fact that's been pointed out, is that the ability of these national football federations to maintain cohesion, especially with their national managers, has been a problem. And then the teams don't really have the opportunity to gel. You have a situation where, like, Sven Goran Eriksson comes in, barely gets to prep the team in advance of the tournament. Did you see that as part of the problem that those sides faced in the tournament?
Certainly it doesn't help to change coaches with the frequency that many of these top African sides do. I think it's a problem driven primarily by the desire of the top federation officials and in some cases even top politicians to get results in the short term rather than look at the long-term success of the national sides. So, yes, I do think that is part of the problem, but I don't think we can reduce the issue to just one factor. I think there's some other factors involved as well, like, for example, the state of most of the domestic leagues in Africa, which is actually quite poor, and most of the star players play in Europe. I think that's also a major factor to consider in the rather disappointing performance of some of the top African sides.
What was the response in South Africa and from what you can sense across the African continent to Ghana's victory over the USA and moving into the quarterfinals?
From what I could see, everyone was quite pleased that Ghana, had flown the African flag high and had gotten such a good result. Pan-Africanism is still fairly strong sentiment in the world of soccer. It's hard to see it in other aspects of society, but in soccer you still have that strong solidarity across the continent. And yeah, the South Africans were extremely excited to have Ghana go through, and also some of the other African immigrants here in South Africa seem to be quite strongly behind Ghana. And I think it's symbolic also that it is Ghana that has gone through to the quarterfinals, because Ghana has historically been one of the strongest proponents of Pan-Africanism. So it's quite apropos that they're the ones who have gone the farthest in this tournament.
You know, it is very interesting, just sort of an aside on the game on the field, to see some of these teams gel the way that they do gel. And you know, it's true that the guys who are going to be on the team, it's known in advance, but everybody's playing their club season. They don't really come together until the weeks right before the tournament in the final configuration that these teams are going to be in for the tournament. And so, you know, they've only played four games, and I think Ghana is a team that has incredible talent. They have great cohesion in terms of their structure on the field, and they have a good shot at getting to the semis against Uruguay, and who knows who they'll play after that, likely either Holland or Brazil, and you never know. There is enough there to give those teams a match, so that could be something. If they could make it to the finals, that would really be something. So the tournament in general, you're in South Africa, it's a little hard. As much as all of us and the listeners who are listening to this show, I'm sure, myself, those of us who are following the tournament closely, to get a real sense of how it feels to be in South Africa. So first, just some impressions of what it's like to be there, and then maybe if you see any critiques or criticisms you'd like to make about how this is fitting into African society or South African society.
Well, I think it's important to keep in mind that South Africa is a big country, and the World Cup is playing out differently in different cities and provinces. I've had the good fortune of traveling around a little bit in this tournament, so I've been to Johannesburg, which is, of course, the hub of this World Cup, with two major stadiums, and also Pretoria, very close by. And there, I mean, it's an all-absorbing thing. Everywhere you see the World Cup, everywhere you go, in the large fan parks, in the streets, and of course in and around the stadiums. I also went to Polokwane in the northern province of Limpopo. And I think it's a small town. It's a rather sleepy town. And there wasn't as much excitement up there as there was in Johannesburg. But I think the South African government should be commended for trying to bring the tournament to places that are sort of off the tourist map in general, and places that are not, you know, at the center of the African football culture, really trying to bring some of the benefits or potential benefits to places other than the major metropolitan areas. I've been to Durban, and there, you know, it's probably one of the finest places to follow the tournament, because the stadium is right on the Indian Ocean, the fan park is a short walk away on the beach, and the weather is wonderful. And, you know, it's playing out differently there. It has a more carnivalesque feeling. There are fewer lines, and, overall the football has been quite good. I've been to Nelspruit near Kruger National Park. Completely different situation there. You drive 370 kilometers, about 250 miles or so from Johannesburg, and you suddenly emerge by a 45,000-seat stadium that seems like it's really just been constructed for no other purpose than to host these four matches, and you wonder, how is this stadium going to survive when the World Cup is gone? In Johannesburg, of course, you've got millions of people, and it's the economic heartland of the country with the biggest soccer teams. But what about Nelspruit? You know, how is this stadium going to survive? What is the long-term sustainability of this facility? I had real questions about that as I left that city just about a week ago. So, you know, I think overall the tournament is really bringing about a lot of excitement in the country, but also it has raised some questions about, you know, the cost of the tournament, particularly the stadiums, and how some of these stadiums are going to be used after the World Cup is gone. And there is quite a bit of debate about this within the country, which I think is a sign of a healthy democratic society, which is not sort of cowing to, you know, government propaganda, but rather is openly discussing these very serious issues.
I'm speaking with Peter Alleghi. He is the author of a brand new book called African Soccerscapes: How a Continent Changed the World's Game. One of the criticisms we've heard is when you actually get close to the event, you know, you're in the town you're in, and then you sort of get to a place, and once you go inside a certain area, it's all FIFA controlled, such that and it's such a sort of wide area around the stadium that vendors are not getting as much from the tournament as they would have hoped, and in fact, once you're inside, it's all McDonald's and Coca-Cola and such.
Well, look, I mean, the exclusion zones are written into the host city agreements that every city signed with FIFA, you know, and that happened about 3 years ago. This is no surprise to the South African government. They were, very much on board with this plan. The stadiums that I've been to, the exclusion zone is not that wide. Maybe a mile or so, and in some cases a little less than a mile. What's been more disheartening talking to the vendors has been the fact that there haven't been as many people. There hasn't been as much business as they thought they were going to be getting. Basically, the way you arrive at the stadium for most people is you park your vehicle about anywhere between a couple of miles and as far as 7 or 8 miles from the stadium, and then you're taken by shuttle buses to the venue. And around those parking areas and where you get dropped off in front of the stadium, there is space for vendors, but most of them are quite disappointed with the level of business that they've been doing. And there have been a lot of empty seats at the stadiums, and that's been a matter of concern for FIFA and for the organizers. It's interesting how these things get reported in the media. Here in South Africa, FIFA is taking quite a bit of criticism from South Africans for the kinds of things you were talking about. But I think it's not entirely proper, I think, for the South Africans to blame FIFA for all these problems, since the South African government knew very well what the terms of the agreement with the World Soccer governing body were at the beginning. So I think that needs to be taken into account as well.
I might as well ask you today, because it is sort of the big hot topic relating to the tournament, which are the two controversial calls in both the England-Germany match and the Mexico-Argentina match. You're obviously in South Africa. FIFA is this massive presence for the event that you're following. What's your sense of FIFA? And obviously the main gripe is they're just a mysterious, unaccountable organization.
Yeah, I think some South Africans knew what FIFA was like and their modus operandi, but a lot of them did not, and they sort of approached it a bit naively, perhaps. And now they've been awakened to the fact that, FIFA is a money-making machine, first and foremost, despite their nonprofit status under Swiss law, right? I mean, they're $1 billion in the black in their last financial report, plus they have $1 billion of equity. That's a lot of cash on hand. That's a lot of resources on hand for a nonprofit organization that, as you said, operates very much outside of the rules of accountability and even transparency. So South Africans have been concerned with that. But again, there's less discussion about the role of the South African government and even the private sector in South Africa and how they have dealt with FIFA. Because nobody from FIFA pointed a gun to South Africa's head and said, you must host the World Cup, right? I mean, South Africa has been very, very enthusiastic about hosting sporting mega events. They hosted the Rugby World Cup in 1995, the All Africa Games in 1999, the Cricket World Cup in 2003. There's very much a mega event strategy that South Africa has been pursuing for many years. But I think they haven't encountered the kind of money-making enterprise that FIFA really has become until now. In terms of the calls, I mean, the refereeing has been below standard in many, many of these games, and South Africans are talking about that and saying, hey, maybe our own referees aren't as bad as we thought they were.
Yeah, there's been some howlers there, to use the term for what happened to poor Robert Greene. Here in the United States, I'm sure you're aware this has been responded to much more enthusiastically than any World Cup in history, including really the one that was in the United States in 1994. A large part of that had to do with the run, the dramatic run of Team USA. What was your sense of how Team USA was received in South Africa?
You know, I thought a lot of people were surprised at the skill that the Americans were showing, but also their commitment and their determination. I was at the U.S. Slovenia match in Johannesburg, and you know, there was a South African family sitting next to me, and you know, they were remarking on the fact that, you know, the Americans were down 2-0 at the half and came back and really played their hearts out and should have won. Actually, should have taken the game 3-2 had it not been for that horrible call that the referee made on the last goal that Edu scored. So you know, that was just an anecdote, but it seemed to me that a lot of people were impressed. You know, and they kept asking me, how did America get so good? And I said, you know, 16 years ago, the U.S. hosted the World Cup. We were very much a sort of marginal power in the world's game. But that was 16 years ago, and MLS has grown tremendously. And, you know, the game at the grassroots level has become much more sophisticated. And it's starting to show, with also players playing in the top European leagues, as many most of the Americans are. You know, I think the Americans are going to be a power within the next, you know, 10 years or so. I think we can expect the U.S. to be making it not only to the round of 16 on a regular basis, but hopefully into the quarterfinals and maybe beyond. So, you know, it was fun to watch, and there were thousands and thousands of Americans at the games, and it was interesting to watch how American fans acted, because it was quite distinct from the other fans. I saw tailgating taking place, which is not common at soccer games, including international games, and also, you know, people with their shirts off, with USA painted on their chests, and that was very exciting to see the Americans really getting into the World Cup atmosphere and shaping it.
Was there any kind of negative reaction to Team USA or the American fans, just because of any kind of political resentment people might have towards the United States?
I didn't pick up on any, you know, very forceful negative feelings in terms of booing or chanting against the U.S. in any way. And I think, you know, that's a sign also of the kind of gracious hosts that South Africa have been, you know, throughout this tournament with everybody. But certainly talking to people, you know, the United States is not very high on people's sympathy meters for political reasons. And that's totally understandable given United States, you know, aggressive foreign policy in particular in the past 7 years or so. But once again, you know, it's interesting to see how people can differentiate sort of government policy versus, you know, the people. There was no hostility that I could see at all towards American fans. But yeah, it was tough. It was tough to get a lot of non-Americans to support the American team.
You know, it is clear when you watch the matches on TV that certain sort of clubs that have the global superstars on them, the stands are filled. You know, in England versus Germany, the stands are filled. Brazil plays, the stands are filled. South Korea played Uruguay in a second-round match. The stands weren't full. What do you make of the games that do have available seats? Why are they not filled? Why are the tickets not then, you know, given away or at greatly reduced prices so that people who otherwise couldn't afford to get in could get in if they wanted to?
That's an excellent question. Every game that I've been to, I think I've been to seven games so far, has had empty seats, including Brazil-Portugal on Friday, which was a game that supposedly was sold out, you know, very, very soon after the tickets went on sale in 2009. There were only 62,000 of us there, and the official capacity of the Durban Stadium is somewhere between 68,000 and 70,000, depending who you talk to. So at least 10% of the seats were vacant. People didn't come. And, you know, in some cases, there were there were only 75% of the seats sold. This morning, the South African newspapers were full of reports of ticket frauds being perpetrated against certain companies that had bought tickets. But I think that cannot be the only reason or even the major reason for so many seats being empty. I think the truth of the matter is that FIFA charges a lot of money for the premium seats. We are in a major global recession. South Africa is far away from Europe and from South America and North America, where most of the soccer fans are. And that's harmed ticket sales. Furthermore, tickets were sold through the internet, through this centralized ticketing system that FIFA put together, and it didn't work very well. And as a result, we have a situation where even in the round matches of this tournament, we're going to have empty seats, which is absolutely outrageous given the fact that, you know, South African taxpayers funded the construction of five brand new stadiums. Five stadiums were refurbished substantially and spent, you know, upwards of $6 billion U.S. To host this World Cup. And very few ordinary citizens are getting access to these stadiums, and it's very painful to me, having studied the game and the history of the game in this country, to walk into a stadium and see games kick off with 10,000, 15,000 empty seats in certain cases, knowing that there are so many people who would have loved to have been at those games and who paid to put the show on.
Well, that begs a follow-up question, which is there are parts of South Africa that are, the people are living in just bone-crushing poverty. I mean, we've covered this on the show, and I've seen some video documentaries in recent days about this. The Guardian actually had an exceptional piece a few days into the tournament. Do you have any sense if in these areas of great poverty there's resentment towards the tournament in this regard, or that, in fact, is being embraced and it's a joy to people who are otherwise going through incredible hardship?
Well, I watched the opening match between South Africa and Mexico in a public viewing area in Imbali Township here in Pietermaritzburg, the largest black township in this area, where, you know, just a few years ago there was essentially a civil war going on between the police and the activists fighting against apartheid. And there was mass celebration of the tournament. Everyone was wearing their South Africa jerseys, waving the flag, and just reveling in hosting the World Cup. A matter of great pride for South Africans, rich and poor, black and white alike. You know, I've been somewhat surprised that there hasn't been any greater public expression of resentment towards the fact that so much money has been spent to put on a show that benefits so few people with virtually no trickle-down effect at all. And I think this is largely due to the fact that South Africans are so tremendously passionate about the game that whether you're a nationalist or a communist, a Christian or not, everyone seems to be behind the tournament. And, you know, I think a lot of people are going to realize soon, and many of them maybe are starting to realize it now, that the hangover is going to be a particularly harsh one when they wake up from this massive global party, and that they're going to be paying for it for a long, long time. But for now, the focus really is on enjoying having the world here and learning a lot about foreign cultures. People who don't have money to travel internationally are meeting folks from all over the world, and that's something that's very powerful and very meaningful to people.
Just two more questions, and the first one for fun. What teams do you like in the tournament? Obviously, you're following it closely. Who do you think are going to play in the final on July 11th?
Oh, that's a tough question. The teams that I've liked, and I've been fortunate to watch quite a few of them, Spain, despite that initial loss due to basically Switzerland's refusal to play any kind of football, Spain has been very, very impressive. The way they play as a unit has an almost orchestral quality to it. They have speed, they have skill, those guys have been together for years, and they know each other so well. They're just a joy to watch for any soccer lover, I think, regardless of your loyalty. Argentina has been a pleasant surprise. We expected them to be perhaps a little more inconsistent than they have been, and they just won against Mexico, so they're through to the quarterfinals. I like the way they play. I have not been impressed by Brazil. I watched them against Portugal at the stadium, and I've watched their other games. I've not been impressed with what they're doing. Very defensive and uninspiring. And let's see, who's the other team that I like? I like Uruguay. Uruguay has been really tremendous. They've got it together. They've got Forlan and Suarez, who have been really doing wonderful things on the pitch, and they are also a very cohesive unit, and they've got momentum. And in a four-week tournament, momentum is everything. And so I like those two South American teams, Uruguay and Argentina, and I also like Spain. And Spain remains my favorite to win, actually.
And final question. You're obviously quite a soccer fan. You've written a book, African Soccerscapes. You know the history of African soccer probably about as well as anyone. How much fun is this for you?
Oh, it's been a great ride. I feel extremely privileged and fortunate to be part of it. And I hope to write an account from the inside very, very soon about it.
Well, we will look forward to that and have you back on The People's Game. We've been speaking with Peter Aledje, who is an associate professor of history at Michigan State University, and his new book is African Soccerscapes, How a Continent Changed the World's Game. Thank you for joining us on The People's Game, Peter Aledje.
Thank you, Alan.
This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined right now by Andrew Terranova. Andrew is a teacher in the Los Angeles Unified School District. He is a Glasgow Celtics fan, and he is one of the Southern California Footballistas, a group of enthusiastic soccer players very committed to the political left. Andrew, welcome to The People's Game.
Thank you very much, Alan.
Well, Andrew and I got an interesting conversation after an exchange of emails yesterday about whether it's significant to root for or against Team USA in the World Cup as they face countries around the world, that the victory of the opposition could signify a source of empowerment to countries that have been oppressed throughout the eras of colonialism and imperialism that the United States has been around for. So, Andrew, what are your thoughts on that as the USA went out of the tournament against Ghana?
Well, you know, clearly, I was rooting for the Black Stars, and I was very, very excited at their victory. For me, though, it's more of a question of what is, for those of us who self-identify as left or progressive in this country, the question is more like, do we root for our own national team, for the United States? And if we choose to do that, what is that actually saying internationally? And so for me, that's something that I think that it's sort of my duty to root against the leader of world imperialism, no matter where they rear the head, whether it's at a WTO conference or whether it's on the football pitch. And so for me, that's just a sort of basic rule. And I think it's been interesting. This cup, as the U.S. is getting stronger and had a good run this cup, it's been interesting because I think we've had those conversations of those of us on the left have been having those conversations with some of us choosing to support basically any other team than the U.S. or some of us rooting for the U.S.
One of the lines that I've taken in this conversation, we have dealt with this territory on The People's Game, is that the United States team and their success translates into greater coverage in the U.S. media and greater popularity for soccer. Certainly, it's the highest profile soccer event that only occurs every 4 years, and a lot hinges in terms of whether soccer is going to catch on in the United States, at least in the mainstream media, with how the U.S. team does in the World Cup. So when they do better, there's more of a sort of media blitz, a greater amount of tension. And my line has been, it's good for the Americans to get involved more in global football because it's entry into a global community and therefore cuts into U.S. nativism, which is really at the core of the really virulent right-wing reaction that's taking place in the country right now. But I do understand why people, when they see the USA face Algeria, USA face Ghana, they would root against the USA.
I would argue that your point is a good one, but in terms of just the broadening experience of U.S. engaging internationally, especially in a sport that they are not uber dominant in, that's an interesting sort of educational experience for the U.S. and it can't result in anything but less nativism. Except I think it's interesting to look at as the U.S. has gained sort of a traveling support, to look at the nature of that traveling support. And I don't necessarily think that it's been such a clear sort of march towards non-xenophobia. I think that if you look at the way a lot of, like we talked about this yesterday, the way a lot of the team's branding and even the way the away supporters call themselves Uncle Sam's Army, and there's a whole discourse around sort of being underdogs in this game. I feel like it's not like we're on a clear trajectory towards non-xenophobia. I think U.S. football is based on the most sort of base level nationalism, but it's a nationalism that comes from the oppressor nations, from the leader of U.S. empire.
Actually, since we spoke yesterday, I did watch Channel 7 local ABC affiliate wrap-up show last night and was appalled at what I saw.
Yeah.
I mean, the USA, I hadn't seen anything like that yet, actually, and I'm sure it's actually being replicated across the country. So that was anything but a positive, progressive, humanist entry into internationalism. It smacked of a really ugly sort of nativist nationalism, in fact.
Sure. I think, though, that, there is something that's just interesting, though. When I'm, like, wandering back to my house from going to get beer for the game today, there's a Nigerian security guard who's talking to some Mexico fans, and they're debating about who's going to be victorious in the cup. And then I walk up, and I say, oh, no, not Uruguay. Mexico's going to win. You know, there's, like, a sort of common bond that develops amongst football fans. But I think that, you know, if somebody walks into that not with that sort of political framework, and they just start, kind of like Homer Simpson-esque chanting USA, USA. It's like that's not about sort of entering into that global community of football, you know.
There are people who maybe don't have as radical an international critique as you do who think that in terms of the left gaining traction in the United States, that the rejection of Team USA by leftists is a very alienating position. How do you respond to that?
That's definitely one I've heard before. And I think, it depends on where, that's a left, like a sort of longstanding left debate, right? Do we see, like, revolution coming from sort of within the empire, right? Or do we see revolution coming from within the third world? Now, historically, there's been tons of debates on that, much longer than either one of us have been on this planet. My own personal opinion is that the places where I see the most politically radical and exciting challenges to empire are not within the working class of the United States, as exploited as they may be, but within the third world, in places like Bolivia, places like Venezuela and things like that. So for me, that's sort of my own orientation, is that I'm not necessarily trying to create a majoritarian movement that will, within the United States, that will somehow elect socialism. I think it's, for me, my own political orientation is more about challenging the hegemony of the U.S. empire to be able to, implement its policies abroad.
Right, and certainly just abject jingoistic nationalism wouldn't really be a part of a transformative socialism within the United States, because one would hope that it really would be informed by an internationalism. I really appreciate your recognition of the complexity of it. And what side are you rooting for in the World Cup?
So I'm rooting for Mexico, and because I'm in historical Aztlán here in Southern California. I think it's an exciting team. In terms of footballing, a lot of these guys run the U-17, U-20 team that won the World Cup a couple of years ago.
Correct. Yeah.
They've graduated to the first team or the selección, and I'm not in under any illusions of the match they're about to play with Argentina in a couple of minutes here, but I think it'd be a fun run. So that's who I'm rooting for. Again, like I think. you know, what did Galeano say? Like, I'm a beggar for good football, and I don't really care who it comes from. I'd prefer it to come from the third world, but if it's a pretty play, I might even clap for a German or something.
Well, there's one English-language country left in the 2010 World Cup, and that is Ghana.
That's right.
So
that's right.
And we're in touch with the Cata Sandlanders in Ghana, and we'll bring them back on and other folks from Ghana to talk on the People's Game. And Andrew Terranova, Southern California Footballista, I want to thank you so much for bringing this perspective so
thank
clearly
so
and
much,
eloquently to the People's Game.
All right, take care.